Welcome back. I'm Max Bergman, director of the Stuart Center in Europe-Russia-Eurasia program at CSIS.
And I'm Maria Snеговая, senior fellow for Russia and Eurasia.
And you're listening to Russian Roulette, a podcast discussing all things Russia and Eurasia from the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Russian Roulette. I'm Maria Snеговая, and I'll be recording solo today while Max is on the road. Today, I'm joined by two very special guests. We're really lucky to have them. First is Eddie Fishman. Eddie is a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University's School of International Public Affairs, my alma mater, actually. Among other roles, Eddie previously worked on sanctions policy at the U.S. Department of State during the Obama administration, playing a critical role in designing and implementing sanctions against Russia and Iran. We're also joined today by a previous guest on the podcast, Dr. Sergei Alexashenko. Sergei is an economist, former chairman of Merrill Lynch Russia, served as Russian Deputy Minister of Finance from 1993 to 1995, and first Deputy Chairman of the Russian Central Bank from 1995 to 1998, all the dating 1990s. Must have been fun, Sergei. Eddie, welcome to the Russian Roulette, and Sergei, welcome back. We're really honored to have you today for what appears to be, obviously, a really important and timely conversation about the Western sanctions regime leveled against Russia. Do the sanctions work? Do they not? What can be improved? In particular, our team here at CSIS is continuing on our work on this topic, trying to understand why haven't sanctions brought the Russian economy to a standstill? What are the most relevant new developments? And how can the Western coalition backing Ukraine innovate so the sanctions actually have more bite? These are all the topics that we'll be discussing today. And let's jump right in. Eddie, let's start with you. You generally appear to be more optimistic about how sanctions can be improved to actually really, really create a lot of problems for Kremlin. I really hope this really will be the case eventually. Maybe the moment has come, because last week on June 12th, the U.S. Treasury announced a new round of measures that increased the risk that foreign firms who aid Russia's war effort could find themselves facing secondary sanctions by U.S. government in addition to sanctioning the Russian stock exchange and many other restrictions that were announced last week. As a former U.S. government official working on sanctions policy, could you please unpack for us what this announcement means and whether you think it will have a meaningful impact on the Russian military's ability to supply its war machine, obviously the most important question these days.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Maria. I'm a longtime fan of Russian Roulette, so I'm really honored to be here today and to be alongside someone like Sergei. Look, it's not always easy to separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to these sanctions announcements. The sanctions regime now is 2.5 years old, and we've seen so many different announcements that sometimes it can kind of just go over your head, say, oh, this is just more of the same. You know, in my view, though, last week's sanctions deserve our attention because I think they're the most significant escalation of sanctions we've seen since the summer of 2022, when the EU agreed to its oil embargo on Russia, as well as a price cap, you know, that were agreed that summer and then put into place at the end of 2022. The reason it's so important is that up until now, the US has threatened secondary sanctions against firms that are transacting only with Russian defense and technology companies. And that's a fairly limited subset of the types of transactions that banks may be carrying out with the Russian economy. There's only about 1,000 of those entities that are sanctioned. And more to the point, if you look beyond just the number of companies that are sanctioned, all of the transactions that are happening with the Russian economy, it's a very small percentage that are going to companies like Rostec, for instance. What changed last week is that that threat of secondary sanctions is now not just against transactions with Russian defense and technology companies, but every Russian individual and company that is under sanctions. So that list has gone from about 1,000 entities to almost 5,000. So it's gone up by 5 times. But most importantly, it includes Russian banks, including, of course, Sberbank and VTB, which are the two largest Russian banks and have been under sanctions since 2022. So why is that important? Any transaction that you're doing with a Russian company, that Russian company will have a Russian bank, right? So in the vast majority of transactions, these banks that are now under the threat of secondary sanctions are involved. So for example, if a Chinese bank, after last week's announcement, is doing any sort of business with Russia that is involving Sberbank or VTB, that Chinese bank could lose access to the U.S. financial system, which is a huge threat for any bank, whether it's in China, the United Arab Emirates, or Turkey. There are still exemptions. This isn't an absolute threat. First of all, not every Russian bank is under sanctions. You still have the big outlier, which is Gazprom Bank, which we can talk more about, I'm sure, later in the interview, which is not under sanctions. And more critically, the U.S. continues to have a broad exemption for energy payments. So normally in sanctions regimes, there are exemptions for food, medicine, and oftentimes telecommunications. Those exemptions do apply to Russia, but then there's this very important additional exemption, which is for energy. So what I'm going to be looking for now in the next few weeks is, what do banks do in response to this? Because theoretically, that Chinese bank that I mentioned before, if they're transacting with Sberbank to process a payment for Russian energy, that's actually allowable, right? But if you take yourself into the boardroom of a bank, how can a bank be confident when they're just processing a transaction that that underlying transaction is for energy versus any other type of transaction? It's very hard is the answer. And that's why we see this phenomenon we call sort of within the sanctions practitioner world, de-risking, where banks say, you know what? There are some types of transactions we could continue doing with Russia. There's some business we could do with Russia. But in order to be sure that we're only doing the allowable transactions, it would cost so much in compliance that it's just not worth it. And so what I expect is we're going to start seeing large and medium-sized banks all around the world, be they in China, Turkey, the UAE, or certainly Europe. You've already seen Raiffeisen now pull back from Russia. I think you're going to start seeing a much larger wave of de-risking in the coming weeks and months after the announcement of last week. And then finally, Maria, before turning it back over to you, you asked, will this actually work? Will this stem the flow of goods to Russia's war machine? That is ultimately the goal that the Biden administration stated. Proof will be in the pudding. We'll see in the next few months, but I'm cautiously optimistic. Previously, the U.S. entrusted export controls to do the trick, right? To stop companies from actually selling, you know, goods to Russia's military industrial complex. But what we found is it's very hard to police the thousands of companies that are exporting widgets to Russia, right? A lot of these companies probably don't even have sanctions compliance divisions or maybe have a couple people working on it. What has happened now is instead of relying on these individual companies to police export controls, we're now depending on banks to be on the front line and to actually police the payment channels into Russia. The reason that Emirati or Turkish or Chinese companies are selling widgets to Russia's military industrial complex is because Russia is paying them for those widgets. And so what we're doing now is we're telling banks, you can't process that payment. And so if an exporter who yesterday was happy to sell semiconductors to Russia can't get paid by Russia for those semiconductors because of these secondary sanctions, they're not going to continue doing that business. So I do suspect that in the coming weeks and months, we will see financial de-risking away from Russia. And then sort of as a slightly lagging indicator, we'll start seeing imports as well into Russia's military industrial complex start going down because of these secondary sanctions.
Fascinating, Eddie, but I would like now to get perspective by Sergey. Sergey, you are certainly more skeptical of the ability of current sanctions policy to really radically undermine the Kremlin's ability to fight this war. What is your reaction to Eddie's comment, quite optimistic take on these recent developments? Is it really feasible? Also, I don't know to what extent the banks even have this ability, to enforce this. I've heard complaints about coming from the banks that they now have to expand their compliance departments and whatnot. So what do you think?
Maria, first, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be with you today and with Eddie, who is really optimistic and who believes that sanctions will work as prescribed, though I think it's over-optimistic. Should remember that, first of all, going to your question, no sanctions can stop war machine. This war is existential war for Putin, and it doesn't matter for him what price he's paying, how costly is the war, what are consequences, long run, medium run, short run, because he wants this war, and he will do it. And it's not a problem of money, because he is ready to sacrifice any other expenditures, and in the global economy where it's not universal sanctions, only, let's say, half of the world, in GDP, maybe 60% of the world aligned sanctions regime, while another 40 did not. So if you want to overpass sanctions, it's the question of price. It's market economy. Transactions are more costly, transaction costs higher. So if you need semiconductors, you will pay a little bit more and you will get them. I understand that the idea is to block operations with the Russian banks that are under sanctions. Okay, Russia has 360 banks, not all of them under sanctions. If all Russian banks will be under sanctions, that means Russia will not be able to get its funds for the export of oil, gas, metals, wood and pulp, fertilizers and so on, and it will be a disaster for the global economy. Moreover, it's very easy to establish a dozen of intermediary companies and semiconductors will be purchased not by Rostech, but the affiliate of affiliate of affiliate of affiliate of Rostech. And you will never find who is the owner of this company. And this week it will be company A, next week it will be company B. So then none of them are under sanctions. And while FARC will find the final consumer of the semiconductors, it will be company Z. I do not believe these sanctions will work, but we shall see. In any event, it will not stop the war, and I hardly believe that it will be visible on the macroeconomic indicators that Russian economy will slow down.
So that's kind of a very different sovereign take, I'd say. In that sense that, essentially, I guess my reading of what Sergey is saying is, there will be just additional elements added to this chain of transactions, which eventually will lead to the same effect, even if, with, as we see already, right, with maybe more higher costs incurred on the components that the Kremlin is getting, maybe worse quality, but nonetheless, they're still getting them. Do you have a response to that? Or do you think the banks is a real game changer?
Yeah, look, I think maybe Sergey and I don't disagree as much as he thinks we do. I don't believe that these sanctions are going to stop Putin's war machine. I think that's a much too high of a threshold for us to consider success for sanctions. What I do think they will do is significantly throw sand in the gears of Russia's military-industrial complex. I think up until now, Russia has faced minimal hurdles in terms of taking its oil revenues and using those proceeds to pay for the imports it needs for its military-industrial complex. I think the banks, by putting them on the front line of the sanctions, will make it much harder and more costly for Russia to do this type of trade. And I do think maybe where we diverge is I think it will be evident in some of the macroeconomic indicators. We've already seen, for instance, since the threat of secondary sanctions, even just limited to the defense companies, was put in place in December of last year, we've seen a drop in Turkish exports to Russia, for instance. And so I think that's one indicator. We've seen some of the bigger Russian Chinese banks already rein in some of their Russia business. And we've seen the Russian government basically come out and say that RMB liquidity is a real risk to the Russian financial system. So I think that, you know, these secondary sanctions that were put in place, this expansion last week is a significant escalation. And I think that these problems that we've started just to see a little hint of in the last 6 months are going to get a lot worse.
Let's hope that will be the case. I'll just mention our own analysis called back the report that was published a couple of months ago back in Stock, in which we also trace this dynamic of sanctions circumventions. And while the Turkey case is interesting, because while there was actually a decrease of direct supplies from Turkey to Russia, we've also found that there is an increase of those supplies from Turkey to countries neighboring Russia, right? That is against this constant cat-mouse game where essentially it certainly probably increased the transaction costs, but doesn't really undermine the supply of those articles. We'll see, I guess, but in any case, it's a welcome development that the administration is going after the banks, and at least my experience has been that banks are far more eager to ensure compliance. Sergey, among the points that you've made about the Western sanctions regimes, you've pointed out one particular aspect of the sanctions, which, if anything, will be reinforced probably by the last set of restrictions. You've been mentioning, and correct me please if I'm wrong, that essentially sanctions, by limiting the financial institutions' ability to deal with Russia, sort of locking in money inside of Russia, and so essentially Putin has a lot of money. Many Russians, oligarchs, or you name them, who would potentially like to take the money out of Russia, are now stuck with them, and they have few choices other than funding the Kremlin war machine. Is that right? And to what extent do you think this current set of sanctions kind of reinforces the same trend? And what would be an alternative?
Marie, yes, you are right to a certain extent. I believe that the real area where sanctions may work, financial sanctions, economic sanctions, is increasing costs for the Russian economy. And one of the most visible, as I said before, it is inflation. So high transactional costs, higher costs is about inflation. And inflation distorts not only economy of military production, it doesn't matter for Putin, he is ready to pay any price. But high inflation distorts the living standards, it distorts public opinion, it distorts a federal budget, because budget needs to run indexation for social benefits, for current expenditures, and so on and so far. Russia is a very interesting country where approximately a quarter of food products purchased by households are imported, and more than 50% of non-food products purchased by households are imported. That means that the exchange rate of the ruble or exchange rate of the dollar in Russia is one of the most important long medium run driver of inflation. The lower is the ruble, the higher is inflation. So imposing cap on the oil price is a way to reduce the supply of foreign exchange in Russia. And that means that the balance between supply and demand shifts, the ruble should depreciate. But the same result you may achieve if you allow capital outflow. It's not only about sanctions, it's about sanctions policy, but households and private payments out of Russia, they are restricted. And not restricted by sanctions. There are no sanctions that ban households' payment out of Russia. And any Russian citizen who has an account in Russia and who has an account in Europe or in the United States is allowed legally to pay, to transfer funds. Moreover, Central Bank of Russia allows such a transfer amounting $1 million per month. $1 million per month. That's the limit imposed by the Central Bank of Russia in March of 2022. While in practice, if you will try to do such a transfer, you will find that no one bank will be ready to do it, with a very rare exception. If you are a client of a bank with a long-term history, past triples, KYC, and so on and so far. So as soon as the Western sanction policy, on phone call policy, it's not a sanction regime, bans transfer out of Russia, those money, they stay in Russia. And the supply of the foreign exchange is exceeding the demand. And it's funny that in the sanctions imposed a week ago, there were sanctions on the Moscow exchange. The first reaction, okay, it's a collapse of the foreign exchange market. Nothing happened. And today, a ruble appreciated by 3%, suddenly. Yeah, because something happened in the market, some new barriers, some outflows of the capital out of Russia. They block transactions and they keep money in Russia. They allow Russian citizens to purchase more. What Eddie rightly mentioned, that export from Turkey to Russia declined. Yes, that's true. Not only from Turkey. Starting somewhere September, maybe last year, the overall import to Russia is declining, steadily declining. That means that the demand for foreign exchange is declining. So while oil price, metal price, they are high enough and Russia keeps very, very strong positive current account, and that means the ruble is appreciating. Yeah, ruble is appreciating and inflation is decelerating. So the real policy is not influencing inflation, not incentivizing inflation, but try to stop inflation in Russia and to help Putin to keep macroeconomic situation stable. That's a mistake, and I really believe that it's one of the biggest mistakes in the sanctions policy is to block all types of capital flight out of Russia. You should incentivize it. You should open channels. Not forgetting about KYC, but let's imagine that you have 100,000 Russians who are able to transfer $10,000 per month. It's a huge amount. It's equal to $1 per barrel per year, price of oil. So I think what's easier, you cannot control price of oil because it does not exist. There is no market where you can check the real price of oil. Find the solution.
I think my take is a little different because while yes, it's true that it's harder to get money out of Russia because of sanctions. It's also true that in the very beginning of the sanctions regime in February of 2022, once there was sort of this massive sort of financial risk that had been built in the Russian financial system, you saw the Russian government impose very strict and harsh capital controls. You still see on sort of the big enterprises, you know, requirements to exchange foreign exchange earnings for rubles. So my own view is if you were to actually start seeing very significant capital flight out of Russia, some of the harsh capital controls that we saw in 2022 would just be reimposed. So the question is, if we were to remove sanctions, would there all of a sudden be some capital flight? It's something that isn't maybe an interesting, you know, academic question, but not one that really has any practical significance, because I think the benefit that the Russian economy would get from greater access to the international financial system would outstrip any potential increase in capital flight. That said, I mean, I do think there are weaknesses in the sanctions regime. So I don't think that the sanctions regime as currently constructed is optimal, and we can get into that. I don't think that the reason that the sanctions regime is deficient is because of too many banks being sanctioned. In fact, I think it's because of the exemptions in the sanctions. It's the, you know, the fact that Gazprom Bank is not under sanctions. It's the fact that General License 8 has been exempting energy payments from the beginning of the war. Those are the deficiencies of the sanctions, not the fact that we have too many banks under sanctions.
Sergio, would you like to respond to that? I want to just comment to our audiences, you know, a political science with me can help but enjoy the fact that economists also cannot agree on so many things, even if the economics is supposed to be actually the only true social science. But no, Sergey.
Maria, I want to reemphasize that the ban on the capital flight of private households, capital flight out of Russia, is not a sanction policy. It's not about sanctions. There is no sanctions that prohibit Russians to transfer funds abroad. Yeah, it's a phone call policy. And that's not transparent because nobody says, yes, it is a policy. Yes, it is intentional decision. Yes, we want to block. But in fact, just put yourself in the shoes of ordinary Russians. Some of them fled from Russia. They live in Europe. They live in other countries. They want to transfer assets from Russia abroad and just to help them to survive. And they cannot do it. Why? Because someone does not allow to do it. And you cannot understand who does not allow, because there are no sanctions. It's worse than a crime. It's a mistake.
I'll just make two points on my side that I agree with Eddie that once the outflow, if we allow the outflow, let's put it this way, and everybody starts taking money out of Russia, I'm sure Central Bank of Russia will instantly intervene, just as Eddie pointed out, it happened at the start of the war. And last but not least, we also should be considerate of the impact of Russian money in the West, right? It's not a secret that prior to war, unfortunately, often been used not for the most benevolent purposes, right? There's this notion of toxic oligarch money, and often it's been used to corrupt the officials in the West. Sergey.
Maria, do you really believe that any Russian oligarch will transfer his funds out of Russia to Europe right now or to the United States? Are they crazy? No, we are talking about ordinary Russians. You may limit by $1 million per month, you may limit by $100,000, you may limit by $10,000 per month. It's not about oligarchs, and it's not about sanctions. And if you say, okay, if we allow capital flight out of Russia, Central Bank will impose if and when, okay, guys, you can predict, as we discussed in the beginning, that, okay, there's a secondary sanctions, bank will be banned to do it, they will be required to take KYC and so on and so forth. My answer, okay, there is an evasion. You can establish an intermediary company. That means let's not impose those sanctions. It's not true. You impose sanctions, you look on the outcome, you look on the reaction, it's a mouse and cat, you're right, said. Yeah, but if you say, okay, Central Bank will impose capital control, they impose a capital control. And there is not a lot of that more than they do. They exhausted their capabilities.
Well, we certainly should keep this debate in mind. But I think one thing that all of us can agree is that it is crucial that we somehow figure out a way to undermine the Kremlin's oil revenues, which is one of the main reasons that the war machine continues to run so smoothly. Eddie, in your past work, you designed sanctions against Iran, cutting off Tehran's energy revenues, which turned out to be critical. And actually, from our perspective, we published a report with the CSIS last year, actually ended up contributing to social discontent. And as Sergey pointed out, inflation in Iranian case also played a very significant role. Today's Russia continued profits from hydrocarbon exports allow it to postpone the kinds of hard domestic spending choices that sanctions are normally supposed to trigger. In fact, see some really miracles on the Russian side. Despite these sanctions from hell, its economy outpaced both the United States and Europe in terms of growth last year, and it can even get worse this year, as Russia is projected to get even higher energy revenues in 2024 at this point. So what are your thoughts on this? What are the different ways that the Western coalition could go after the Russian energy revenues, given the multiple shortcomings of the G7's oil price cap? And is it possible to do without damaging the global economy? Everybody keeps pointing out, right, that Russia, unlike Iran, Russia's oil sales are about 10% of global oil sales, so that's actually very significant. And is this feasible? What do you propose?
Yeah, this is the critical question we have, because since the very beginning of the Ukraine war, the West has tried to maximize sanctions on Russia's economy without affecting Russia's major cash cow sector, which is the energy sector. And I think what we're bumping up to against now, and I think in particular after the secondary financial sanctions were put in place last week, is that we've almost exhausted all avenues for pressuring Russia without going after Russia's oil revenues aggressively. I do think it's possible. So I think that's, you know, sort of my bottom line is, you know, we shouldn't just throw up our hands and say, this is impossible. Russia's too big of an oil producer. We can't possibly impose sanctions. I think we can, but we do have to get creative. There are two options and two sort of different mechanisms you could use to go after Russia's oil sales. The first is to go after the volume of Russia's oil sales. And the second would be to go after the revenues that Russia's making from oil sales. We used a combination of those strategies against Iran, and they worked synergistically, I think, to really make the Iran sanctions bite as hard as they did. To go after the volume of Russia's oil sales, the way you would do that in practice is you would threaten secondary sanctions on buyers of Russian oil unless they agreed to significantly reduce their purchases over time. So, for instance, you would say to an Indian or Chinese refinery that next 6 months, you have to buy less Russian oil than you bought in the previous 6 months. The benefit of this approach is you sort of gradually phase in the reduction of Russian oil exports over time. So you minimize the impact that it would have on global oil supplies. And you also send a market signal to producers, for instance, shale producers in the United States or producers in other countries in OPEC, that they may need to increase production in order to compensate for this gradual reduction in Russian oil sales over time. I do think this is feasible, even though Russia is selling 5 million barrels of crude oil a day and 2.5 million of product, which is a lot more than Iran was selling in 2012 when we put the oil sanctions in place. You could gradually phase those out over a 5 to 10 year period. I think the problem is that's a long time. I don't think it's particularly practical if the goal really is to cause enough financial strain in Russia to potentially change the momentum on the battlefield in Ukraine. So I don't think that's the best option. The better option is to go after Russia's oil revenues. The price cap, of course, was designed to go after Russia's oil revenues instead of the volume, but it was done in a very sort of minimalist or weak manner. A better mechanism would be to replicate the one that we used against Iran, which was to use financial sanctions to effectively prevent Russia from using its oil proceeds in international markets. We did this in the Iran context by threatening secondary sanctions against banks if they were to repatriate oil money to Iran. And what this led to was over $100 billion of Iran's oil proceeds accumulating in restricted overseas bank accounts. And for those who remember the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2015, this was the critical leverage that the United States had, the ability to selectively unfreeze Iran's oil revenues. The way that this would work against Russia would be a little bit more complex, but generally similar. One is you would take this general license, which is General License 8. I mentioned this earlier before. Since the beginning of the war, General License 8 has exempted all energy payments from Russia from sanctions. What you would do is you would limit General License 8 to only transactions for Russian oil that comply with the price cap. So what you would basically be doing is you'd be putting Russian banks, or you'd be putting global banks, on the front lines of implementing the price cap in the same way that they're now on the front lines of implementing export controls against Russia. So banks would basically have to impose their own compliance regimes to try to ensure that Russia's only getting paid a certain amount for its oil sales. I think this would be very, very, very challenging to implement for banks, although I think some would figure it out just because it's a big enough trade that you'd probably find one or two channels that would be able to make this work. The second and more important point is that you would sanction the remaining Russian banks. To Sergei's point, there are some Russian banks that aren't sanctioned, like Gazprom Bank, and require funds that are paid to them to go into restricted accounts in importing countries. So, for instance, if you're a Chinese refinery who's buying Russian oil, you would have to pay into a Russian bank account that's domiciled in China, and those funds could only be used for humanitarian trade. So they could not be used, for instance, to buy semiconductors. This is the model, again, we used against Iran. The beauty of it is that it prevents Russia from using its oil proceeds to finance the war machine, but it doesn't actually do anything in terms of the volume of Russian oil sales. And then so it shouldn't unleash this global economic chaos, I think, that Sergei mentioned before. Why hasn't this happened yet? I think the reason it hasn't happened yet is the Biden administration has been very cautious about doing anything that could potentially restrict the volume of Russian oil sales. And of course, there's the possibility that if the U.S. were to impose this type of sanctions regime, that Putin could retaliate by cutting oil sales significantly, which of course would spike prices. You have to decide whether you think this is a credible threat. My own view is it's not a credible threat. And so I don't think it should be shaping our policy.
That's very interesting, Eddie. My concern isn't we asking too much of the banks, right? They're doing the export control. Now they're going to be also enforcing essentially the oil price cap. Sergey, do you have a comment on that? Maybe you have a better suggestion. Is there, in general, a way to go after Russian oil? And maybe it's along the line that the lines that Eddie has offered.
I have two short comments and one suggestion. Short comments, I fully support Eddie's phrase that Biden's administration was very cautious. So that's it. It's very cautious in any aspect, in military supply, in oil sanctions, in everything. Second comment, I think that Eddie's ideas, they are great. The problem is that China is not a part of the sanction regime and will never be. And my suggestion is, before implementing all these ideas, maybe they could be implemented, I don't know, the United States have to build good relations with Saudi Arabia. Because Saudi Arabia has, at the moment, spare capacity of something like 3 million barrels per day. Russian oil production declined something by more than 20%. It was 11 million barrels per day in 2019. Nowadays, it's about 9 million barrels per day. So it's a lot. But the bulk of this decline was not caused by sanctions, but by the agreements within OPEC, OPEC Plus. And Saudi Arabia has a huge, huge spare capacity. If the United States are able to agree with Saudi Arabia to increase production in exchange of decline in consumption of Russian oil by Chinese or by Indian refineries, that could work. I do not believe that the United States shale industry can produce a lot. I saw the most recent forecast of Energy Information Administration. They foresee that this year oil production in the United States will increase by 0.3 million barrels per day, next year by 0.4 million barrels per day. So it's about peanuts, it's about nothing. If NATO fleet will shut down Danish Straits and Saudi Arabia will pump 3 million barrels of excessive oil, that means that Russian export of oil from St. Petersburg port, from Baltic Sea, it's about 3 million barrels per day. So if Saudi Arabia can do it, if Saudi Arabia can increase supply of oil, that will work. If not, I don't see where the global economy will take oil. Russia is the supplier of 1 out of 6 barrels of oil, including products, in the market.
So essentially the Reagan solution in the 80s, right? That's what you're offering, Sergey.
Marie, it's not Reagan solution. The decline of oil price in mid-80s was not Reagan policy, it was Saudi's policy. But keep it aside, because if Saudis will start pumping oil right now, the first victim will be U.S. shale industry, because their costs are much higher than costs of Russia. It's not a solution. Solution is to shut down Danish Straits by NATO fleet, and then, at the same time, Saudi Arabia to pump extra oil.
Every time we've tried oil sanctions in the last 15 years, you've had folks say, well, let's just get Saudi to pump more oil. We did the same with Iran in 2010, 2011. And I think the difference then was the Saudi regime was saying, cut off the head of the snake. You should be bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. You had a Saudi regime who was very much aligned geopolitically with the United States-Iran strategy. And yet the Saudis would not pump more oil to make the Iran sanctions work. I think that the Saudi government has been very resistant to using its sway over oil markets to help American sanctions. And I don't think that they would be amenable to such a solution. So I applaud Sergey for his creativity. My experience tells me that the Saudis just wouldn't do this. So it doesn't sort of factor into my option set. I think maybe one thing that Sergey may have misunderstood about my comments, because he made the point about China, is that you actually don't need China to sign up to financial sanctions against Russian oil flows for these sanctions to work. In fact, they didn't sign up for the Iran oil sanctions either, and yet they complied with them. And the lion's share of that $100 billion plus of Iranian oil proceeds that I mentioned before were locked in Chinese banks. The reason is, if you think about it from the perspective of Chinese banks, they're being told that they can accept oil payments for Russian oil. They just can't repatriate them to Russia. They can only use them to finance certain types of bilateral trade. So if anything, it's actually good for the Chinese economy. China has a positive incentive to implement this type of sanction, because on the margin, it'll increase Russia's demand for imports from China. Just to be very clear, you don't need the Chinese government to sign off on this policy. We didn't have them sign off on it in 2012 with the Iran sanctions, and yet Chinese banks still complied with it.
Well, let's hope maybe that's feasible. And I'm glad at least that there are certain options, right? I think it's important to flag that we can try and go after the Russian oil revenues, even if it's not a given that it's going to be a perfect solution. What we need, though, is political will. I think we'll agree on that. Sergey, Let's switch gears a bit to what's happening inside of Russia since we've started this conversation talking about the Russian defense development. I wanted to ask your opinion on the recent reshuffling within the Russian elites, and specifically the appointment of the economist Andrei Belousov as the new Minister of Defense. Do you think it makes sense, and does it mean that economy, from the Kremlin perspective, plays the major role in this war? It would be interesting to get your take.
I don't know what is going on in the brains of Vladimir Putin, but if I'm in his shoes, I think it's a very strong solution. It's a very strong decision to appoint Belousov as the Minister of Defense. On the one hand, it is definitely the distinction between Minister of Defense and the head of Etat Major, Mr. Gerasimov. Yeah, it's like in the United States. Yeah. Here you have a Minister of Defense and you have a Chief of Joint Staff, and they're different. And it is Gerasimov, Chief of Staff, who is responsible for the war machine, who is responsible for the army, and Belousov will not deal with it. It's not his job. His job is, that we may say, it's back office. And if I am in Putin's shoes, the nomination of Belousov will not affect current situation. It's a long-run solution. So Belousov needs to be an intermediary between generals who are in the war, between Gerasimov and his team, saying, guys, what type of weapons do you need based on the lessons of this war? You don't need what Rostyakh Chemezov is producing. You need something else. Okay, let's do it. Let's try to analyze and understand what do we need and how much do we need. Then, Belousov, you have to negotiate with Minister of Finance on the budget constraints, and you have to be the chief negotiator with producers, with Chemezov and his team, with Rostyakh, with Mantrov. Okay, guys, we don't need what you produce. You have to produce what do we need. And that's precisely the mentality of Belousov, this ghost plan mentality. I cannot say it's very bad. It is the job he can do. It is not necessary for him to confront generals, to fight with them. He can be their partners. Okay, guys, I want you to deliver what you really need. So, and if it is so, if it is what's going on in Putin's brain, okay, it's a very, very strong decision. Once again, it's not a short run. It's not, nothing will change in the war in Ukraine, because any changes in military production, in ideas of generals will take years. So, but for 6 years, for the presidential term of Putin until 2030, it's good.
That is my interpretation as well, Maria, on the appointment of Belousov as the defense minister. I think it's both, as Sergei mentioned, the desire to bring some level of rationalism and professionalism to the military industrial complex. But I think it also signals that Russia has transitioned to a full-on war economy. And so it's not just that the military machine needs a technocrat like Belousov, it's that economy needs the war to continue to go on. They need the demand from the military industrial complex to continue growing. And the economic growth that you mentioned before, Maria, that is entirely coming from the transition of Russia into this full-on military-industrial state, right? I mean, 40% of the federal budget is now going to defense and security expenditures, right? This is an economy that really is directed at one purpose. From the perspective of sanctions, though, what this tells me is that the economy is also quite brittle, right? You have an economy that is entirely dependent on military production, and insofar as it's dependent on a foreign economy, it's entirely dependent on China, both for energy demand, as well as now increasingly for access to international finance, right, through the RMB being really the only foreign currency that Russia is dealing in these days. So I do think that with a similar amount of determination and long-term strategic thinking on sanctions, the West still has the upper hand. The question is, can we muster that? And I think the biggest question mark there is around the 2024 U.S. presidential election, which will take place in November. But I think if you see Biden reelected, I do think that, you know, the U.S. can put together the type of long-term strategy that's necessary to really come out on top of this economic war.
A very important comment, given the existing imminent threat, unfortunately, that continues to come from Russia. Lastly, unfortunately, it's the last question, but I can't conclude our conversation without flagging the new proposal agreed upon on the recent G7 summit in Italy. The G7 has agreed in principle to leverage the interest earnings on frozen Russian central bank reserves to provide Ukraine with a loan of $50 billion. And simultaneously today, Levada, Russian polling agency, one of the few remaining independent ones, has released a poll showing that while Russians overall are less concerned about the sanctions, like visa sanctions or certain cancellations of Russian artists abroad, they do remain concerned about the central bank reserves for a reason. They are really over half of the respondents actually expressed concerns about this topic. So does this new development, the fact that G7 agreed in principle to leverage the interest earnings on the frozen reserves, represent certain kind of breakthrough in the debate over how to use Russian frozen bank reserves in service of the Ukrainian war effort? That's a good news, or is it just another development that's not going to be really consequential? Sergio, maybe let's start with you this time.
No, yeah, it's fake news, because this has nothing common with foreign reserves of the Russian central bank. The issue is very simple. There is a Belgian organization named Euroclear. That is the central European bank depository for trading in bonds. And Central Bank of Russia invested before the war $190 billion or euros, I do not remember precisely, via this organization. So in the accounts of the Euroclear, there were assets of the Russian Central Bank amounting $190 billion. So let's imagine that all those bonds, deposits, etc., they were redeemed, repaid. And nowadays, in the account of Euroclear, there is a client whose name is Bank of Russia. And this client has $190 billion. And those assets are frozen. That means the Euroclear cannot deduct from this amount, from 190 billion, even 1 cent. But Euroclear is a bank. As a bank, it has liabilities and it has assets. Bank cannot, okay, it's a balance sheet of the bank. So Euroclear as a bank, based on his strategy, on his investment directives, on his status, can use those 190 billion as own assets, as a bank, and invest somewhere in overnight deposits. Investing those money in overnight deposits, Euroclear can earn from $3 to $5 billion per year. It is profit of Belgian bank named Euroclear. And there was a special decision of the European Commission to impose a special tax on Euroclear profit amounting 90%. So, and this 90% of Euroclear extra profits nowadays called the interest on the reserves of the Russian Central Bank. Once again, it's a fake news. It's profit of Belgian bank that is taxed with a special tax rate. So that's it. Yes, it's money, but it's not central bank. Central bank had 190 billion. It has 190 billion. And 2 weeks, 2 years, 20 years from now, Central Bank of Russia will have 190 billion if nothing will happen.
I guess this 50% of Russians who are concerned about this frozen reserves can be relieved now.
And 100% of Western citizens believe that there's really drawing of the assets of the Russian Central Bank, of Russian reserves. It's a fake news. It's a fake news.
Thank you, Sergey. Eddie, can I get your comment on that? We certainly wouldn't want to be spreading fake news on this.
I think Sergey's explanation was quite elegant in that we are not confiscating the Russian Central Bank reserves. We are using the profits that are generated in order to provide extraordinary support to Ukraine, right? It's within the right of Western governments to impose whatever tax they think is necessary on that money that has been deposited in financial institutions in their jurisdiction. From a policy standpoint, though, Maria, your question was, is this a big deal? Is this a breakthrough? I think the simple answer is yes, it's a major breakthrough, right? We've been debating now for years what to do with the Russian Central Bank reserves. Obviously, 300 billion frozen in Western bank accounts. It's a lot of money that's just sitting there, not being used for any purpose, while American and European taxpayers are spending hundreds of billions to support Ukraine. It doesn't really make sense. The beauty of this new proposal, it's been called a loan, but it's not actually a loan, right? Ukraine doesn't have to pay back a cent from it. US taxpayers, European taxpayers also won't have to pay a dime. Basically, what it's doing is using financial engineering, using the ability to tax these profits from the immobilized Russian Central Bank reserves to provide a very large disbursement to Ukraine. That initial disbursement as you mentioned, Maria, is going to be $50 billion. But this pool of assets, as Sergey mentioned, isn't going anywhere. And so, you know, this could just be the first of many large disbursements to Ukraine that are created basically out of this pool of frozen assets. I think the beauty of it is that it politically insulates support for Ukraine. As we saw in the United States just a few months ago, it took the U.S. Congress months and months and months to agree to provide $60 billion to Ukraine. This was sort of front page political news in the United States for a long time, and it only really got across the finish line due to some really surprising last minute political compromise. Now, the G7 has effectively doubled that amount without using any taxpayer money and without requiring any approval from a parliament or Congress. So I think what this does is it puts Ukraine on stronger and more durable financial footing for the long term.
Yeah, Eddie, may I ask you a question? You are full of optimism. As I said, this loan will be financed by proceeds from profits of the Euroclear because of the special tax rate for the Belgian bank. As we know, there are about $5 billion of assets of the Russian Central Bank invested somewhere in the United States. Have you heard about special tax rate in the United States for the profits of this money?
The mechanisms for how exactly the US and EU governments are going to actually pay back this amount have not yet been worked out. But I do think some money is going to come from the United States as well. So it's not just the Euroclear money that's going to be tapped for this $50 billion. It's going to be money that's not just in Belgium, but also in the United States and France and other European countries as well, and potentially countries outside of the European Union. I know that there are active discussions with other governments who are outside of the G7 context to potentially participate in these ERAs, as they're being called.
That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I thought it was a very stimulating conversation. We did not always agree, we barely agree with each other. But I think the good news here is that, first of all, clearly the importance of continuing our support for Ukraine and making sure that the sanctions actually work as intended and meaningfully hurt the Russian economy is here. And I think it's also great that there are certain non-conventional solutions about going after Russian oil. What we need is political will in the United States and in the West more broadly. We'll see if that's going to happen. But certainly I wanted to thank our great participants, Ed and Sergey, today for joining us. That was a fantastic conversation. Thank you as well to our listeners for tuning in. As usual, if you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating. Additionally, please be sure to check out our sister podcast, The Europhile, wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
You've been listening to Russian Roulette. We hope you enjoyed this episode and tune in again soon.
Russian Roulette releases new episodes every 2 weeks on Thursdays and is available wherever you get your podcasts. So please subscribe and share our episodes online.
And be sure to check out all the latest analysis by the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at csis.org.